Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story, the Israeli regime presses on with its genocidal war campaign in Gaza despite a UN Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in the besieged territory.
They were all civilians. My brother and his family were displaced from the north. They told them to move to the south. Here is the south. Where is the safety? They bombed them while they were sitting here eating. They didn't even finish their iftar.
More than 30 Palestinians have been killed in fresh Israeli aerial raids on Gaza City. Earlier, the regime's warplanes targeted a house in the north of the city of Rafah, killing an entire family, most of them women and children. Israeli airstrikes also hit Beit Lahia in the north and areas around the Nusayrat refugee camp in central Gaza. Over the past 24 hours, at least 150 people have been killed in Israel's indiscriminate bombings. The Israeli forces have also kept up their attacks in the vicinity of Al-Shifa Hospital, leaving a trail of death and destruction there. Areas around Amal Hospital and Khan Yunis were shelled as well. Since the beginning of the Israeli war on Gaza, more than 32,300 Palestinians have been killed, mostly women and children. Our correspondent Moti Abu Mosabeh joined us earlier from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah to update us on the situation in the besieged territory.
Let's begin from Rafah City, where as an appalling Israeli massacre was committed over the last night after the Israeli warplanes destroyed several residential buildings in the northern part of the city. Mostly women and children were reportedly killed and massacred, while dozens are still trapped and missing under the rubble. In the meantime, when it comes to Khan Yunis City, the Israeli aggression against the Nasser Medical Complex and the Al-Amal Hospital is still continuing so far, with more attacks that are targeting the surrounding areas of those hospitals. According to multiple eyewitnesses, that the Israeli occupation forces kidnapped and abducted dozens of the Palestinian evacuees who are taking shelter in the medical and the Nasser medical complex, and they enforced the women and the children to evacuate into the Al-Mawasi area. When it comes to Gaza City, as you know, the brutal Israeli aggression is still underway against the Al-Shifa Medical Complex and the surrounding areas of the Al-Shifa Medical Complex. More swinging bombardments reached that area, targeted that area, inflicting more destruction in the residential buildings of the Palestinian residents living there. And needless to mention how catastrophic the situation is for the Palestinian evacuees who are still besieged and surrounded inside the buildings of the Al-Shifa Medical Complex. We are talking about hundreds of the Palestinian civilians who are still besieged in those buildings. According to what they have experienced over the last couple of days, whoever surrenders for the Israeli occupation forces, he will be killed by those occupation forces. At least 140 Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed. The vast majority of them were executed in the field, in the yards of the Al-Aqsa of the Shifa Medical Complex.
A UN rights expert says there are reasonable grounds to determine that Israel has committed acts of genocide and ethnic cleansing in its onslaught on Gaza. Francesca Albanese is UN Special Rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territories. She said in a report that Israel has violated three of the five acts listed under the International Genocide Convention. The expert added that the overwhelming scale of Israel's attacks on Gaza reveals the regime's intent is to physically destroy Palestinians as a group. Albanese also asserted that statements by senior Israeli officials about forcible displacement of Palestinians and replacing them with settlers amount to ethnic cleansing. Albanese's report is due to be presented to the UN Security Council on Tuesday. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has reacted to Israel's response to a proposal the group had submitted as part of a truce negotiations that first initiated in Paris. In its statement, Hamas said that it has remained committed to the proposal presented to the Qatari, Egyptian, and American mediators on March 14th. However, the group expressed concern over the Israeli response to the proposal, saying it doesn't meet any of the basic demands of the Palestinian people. Hamas says Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his far-right cabinet bear full responsibility for failure to reach an agreement so far. A comprehensive ceasefire, withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza, return of the displaced, prisoner swap, and reconstruction were parts of the proposal. But Hamas officials have repeatedly accused the Tel Aviv regime of sabotaging the negotiations, the last round of which was held in Doha. The political bureau chief of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has met with the Iranian foreign minister during his visit to Tehran. Ismail Haniyeh sat down with Hossein Amir Abdollahian upon his arrival in the Iranian capital. In the meeting, the two sides discussed the political developments as well as other events surrounding the war-ravaged Gaza Strip. The two top officials are told to join press briefing later in the day. This is Haniyeh's second trip to Tehran since Hamas launched the Al-Aqsa flood operation against Israel over the regime's decades of atrocities against Palestinians. Israeli troops have launched new incursions into several areas across the occupied West Bank, abducting a number of Palestinians. The regime's forces raided the cities of Jenin, Nablus, Qalqilia, and Beit Fajar, among others. In Jenin, they raided homes in a number of neighborhoods and deployed snipers on rooftops as clashes broke out with resistance groups. Meanwhile, Israeli settlers also assaulted several Palestinians, raided homes, and targeted vehicles in Beit Amer as Israeli forces stormed the town. A Palestinian was also shot in the Balata refugee camp on the outskirts of Nablus. Palestinian resistance fighters confronted Israeli forces across the West Bank, targeting them with explosive devices. Our Ramallah correspondent, Mona Kandil, joined us earlier with details on attacks by Israeli forces and settlers that have become daily occurrences in the occupied West Bank.
Let's start with the occupied West Bank, specifically Al-Khalil. The Israeli forces stormed Beit Umar, northern Al-Khalil, and arrested at least two Palestinians from there. Before the Israeli troops stormed Beit Umar, Israeli settlers had raided Beit Umar town and attacked Palestinians and threw stones at the vehicles as well as the homes, as well as smashed the windows of the homes, the windshields of the vehicles. The Israeli settlers claimed that Palestinians from inside the village of Beit Umar opened fire at the nearby Israeli settlement Kermit Sur, and one of the bullets had hit a house there, according to the Israeli settlers. So that's why they claim they attacked the people there. Then the Israeli forces themselves stormed the area and detained Palestinians from inside Beit Umar, as well as preventing any movement to the village or out of the village. The Israeli forces also raided the cities of Doura and Yatta, south Al-Khalil, and attacked Palestinians there, arrested a number of people, set up more checkpoints, preventing any movement to inside or outside those cities south Al-Khalil.
Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement and the Israeli military have once again targeted each other's positions amid growing tensions over the regime's continued bloodshed. In Gaza, Hezbollah has targeted Israel's Bir Anit military base located in the northern occupied territories. It also fired rockets at two other Israeli targets, including the Meron air base in the upper Galilee region, inflicting heavy losses. Hezbollah's operations followed the killing of a resistance member. Meanwhile, Israeli missiles struck two areas in southern Lebanon. There were no immediate reports of casualties or damage from the latest strikes. Hezbollah has been engaged in anti-Israel operations since the regime launched its war on Gaza in October. The resistance fighters mainly target Israeli military positions, but the Israeli regime pounds residential areas in Lebanon, causing civilian deaths. Jordanians have once again attended a rally to express solidarity with Palestinians and denounce Israel's genocidal war on the Gaza Strip. They also demanded the government shut down Israel's diplomatic mission in the country.
The message and will of our Jordanian people and youth. Today, the embassy of shame, the Zionist embassy that defiles our capital Amman, should be closed. It should end. We won't back down. We won't get tired. We won't stop until they shut down the embassy of shame, the Zionist embassy in Amman.
Waving Palestinian and Jordanian flags and chanting slogans, protesters marched to the heavily fortified Israeli embassy in Amman. Police forces clashed with the protesters and fired tear gas to disperse them. According to eyewitnesses, several protesters were beaten up and some of them were arrested during the clashes. Jordanians often assemble in front of Israeli and American embassies to express their anger at the ongoing bloodshed in Gaza. Jordan, that is hosting 2.4 million Palestinian refugees, has witnessed several such rallies in support of Gazans since Israel launched its war on the besieged strip. Today marks the 9th anniversary of the Saudi-led aggression against Yemen, where Riyadh and some of its Arab and Western allies failed to achieve any of their objectives. The leader of Ansar Allah movement has praised the Yemeni nation for their resilience and unity in the face of the war. In a televised address on Monday, Abdul Malik al-Houthi denounced the aggression against his country, saying the goal of unjust and treacherous war was to destroy Yemen. He emphasized that Saudi Arabia's plan was to occupy Yemen and undermine the rights of its people. Houthi said the war resulted in the death or injury of over 50,000 civilians, mostly women and children. Saudi Arabia, along with some of its regional allies and backed by the West, launched a war on Yemen in March 2015 with the aim to reinstate a friendly regime there. Years of bombing campaign and blockade worsened the condition of the Yemeni people. According to the UN Refugee Agency, Yemen remains one of the world's worst humanitarian crises despite a ceasefire. U.S. occupation forces have carried out a series of airstrikes against targets in eastern Syria near the border with Iraq. Reports say American warplanes carried out 10 simultaneous strikes on residential neighborhoods and military installations in Deir al-Zawr province, including the cities of Deir al-Zawr, al-Mayadeen, and al-Wukamal. They say at least 20 people, including women and children, were injured in the attacks. No more details have been provided so far. The United States regularly conducts airstrikes in Syria under the pretext of fighting terrorism. Damascus has written numerous letters to the United Nations calling on the world body to put an end to U.S. attacks and its military presence in the Arab country. Well, London court is deciding whether or not WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange can appeal his extradition to the United States, where he faces up to 175 years behind bars on spying charges. Our correspondent, Saeed Pourrezo, is joining us now from the British capital, London, with all the latest. Saeed, I'm going to pass it over to you and share with us all the latest information that you have with regards to this case.
Right, Barry, as you say, another day, really, in the long and tortuous journey by Julian Assange to justice and freedom. Of course, freedom is yet to come. The court was supposed to decide whether or not Julian Assange still had permission to appeal his extradition to the United States. The court, of course, convened last month, if you remember, and today was supposed to pass that ruling. It's not quite the same thing, and I've brought with me Joe Prack. Is a member of the Julian Assange Committee, a grassroots committee supporting Julian Assange since this whole thing began, all those years ago. He joins me now to explain what today's ruling was and what it means. Joe, we have a ruling. It's not quite the same thing as whether or not Assange can appeal to the British courts at the moment. Interpret what the judges said today.
Well, in typical British fashion, they have granted the appeal, but there are conditions. They have given the Americans 3 weeks to make assurances that Assange would have his First Amendment rights under their constitution granted, and also that they would take the death penalty off the books, as it were, should he be extradited. Now, this is quite alarming in many ways, because instead of going straight to the appeal, they've given the Americans 3 weeks to come up with more excuses of why they should extradite him. And they will have another hearing sometime late in May to go over the Americans' submissions on why they should extradite him if they have the assurances about the First Amendment rights and the death penalty.
If in May this court decides that he cannot appeal anymore, what will that mean? What other avenues will Assange have left to try and block his extradition to the U.S.?
Well, his defense team have already made a submission to the European Court of Human Rights. They can't consider it until all his UK legal options have run out. Should the Americans make these assurances, which are accepted by the High Court here, knowing the British government, they could put him on a military plane overnight and send him straight to the East Virginia district to face the charges of espionage and computer intrusion. They could send him back to Belmarsh to await a decision from the European Court of Human Rights for a further God knows how long, months or years.
In that court in Strasbourg, France, that the UK is a signatory to. We know, we hear from the Assange family, you probably, of course, are filled in about his condition, the state of his health, and that he is not even able to watch this, appear here in person, nor watch it online in prison. What are your fears if he were to be extradited to the U.S., given the fact that the Americans are saying he's going to be treated fairly, that he's not going to spend up to 175 years in prison, that maximum time he will spend in prison will be 60-something months?
Well, we've known for a long time that his physical condition has been very poor. He's been denied medical treatments when needed. He has psychological injuries from the isolation and the confinement, not only at Belmarsh for 5 years, but for nearly 7 years being surveilled and imprisoned at the Ecuadorian embassy. He's in a very bad way. Should he be extradited to the US, there's no doubt in my mind that his life expectancy would be cut down to a matter of weeks or months. You only have to look at the US prison system to see there's no safety in their system from either committing suicide or having some fellow inmate dispose of you in the dead of night when all the video cameras are turned off and the guards are asleep. So the US are well known for mistreating their detainees.
Joe Breck, thank you very much.
Thank
of the
you,
Assange
sir.
Committee. Many thanks. And there you have it, the judgment today. All eyes on the High Court in May, of course, to see whether or not Julian Assange will indeed be able to appeal through the UK courts his extradition to the United States. But one fact remains, and that is his supporters will, of course, be continuing the fight to secure his release, his freedom, once and for all. Bardia.
All right, thanks a lot. Saeed Pirouz joining us from the British capital, London.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though.
Bye.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من، این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم است.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tone should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن، دوری از قرآن، از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
کتاب الله. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 23, 2015 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with government officials on the occasion of the month of Ramadan. We read in another part of the holy dua of Abu Hamza, I cry for the day when they take me out of the grave, naked and feeling terrible. I cry for that day when I will be carrying the heavy load of my sins, and at times I look right and sometimes I look left, and I see that everyone is involved in their own affairs. At that time, everyone is thinking about themselves, and no one will help us in any way. Each one of them that day will have enough concern of his own to make him indifferent to the others. Some faces that day will be beaming, laughing, and rejoicing. The Holy Quran, chapter 80, verses 37 to 39. Believers, the pious, and those who took care of themselves and who did not leave the road of right, justice, and divine responsibilities are described in this sentence. Some faces that day will be beaming, laughing, rejoicing. Their faces are happy, smiling, and bright. Some people are like this, and other faces that day will be dust-stained and blackness will cover them. The Holy Quran, chapter 80, verses 40 to 41. These are ayahs from the Holy Quran, but in the dua of Abu Hamza, the word humiliated has also been added. Of course, this is not the only concept that exists in these prayers.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Like all other prayers, the prayers of the month of Ramadan draw us towards the sweet and pleasant spring of divine mercy as well. This month is the month of humility, repentance, piety, return to God, self-edification, and morality. In the sermon delivered by the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, on the last Friday of the month of Shaban, there are certain points that show this month is not only the month of worshipping God, it is also the month of morality and the month of acquiring and implementing moral qualities. These are points that we should pay attention to in this month. In this very sensitive and important meeting, I have chosen three issues to discuss. One is the issue of the economy, which was pointed to in the statements of the Honorable President. He made good statements and presented good statistics. I too have a viewpoint to discuss in this regard. Another is the nuclear issue, which has become the focus of many of our efforts, whether foreign or domestic ones, in the present time. I have certain viewpoints in this regard that I deem necessary to discuss, and if there is enough time, I will touch on regional matters as well.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh,
the next morning, I continued with my trip to see the Chahku Valley. The valley is about 70 kilometers from the city of Resh. It's located in the eastern part of the island. The trail connecting the village to the valley was fantastic, and the landscape stunning. After a rather long walk, I am finally getting close to the Chahku Valley. What has been so interesting to me is that the valley is green with rich vegetation. Although Resh is rather a dry island with low rainfall, the valley is spotted with trees and bushes. One reason is that this place is protected from the scorching sun. Another reason is that all the rainwater coming from the surrounding areas gathers in here. In addition, the valley's groundwater is great. These reasons have made this valley so lush with vegetation. Finally, I got to the entrance of the Chahku Canyon. It must be very appealing. Look how many eccentric but amazing holes there are at the very beginning point of the canyon. I guess the inside must be much more beautiful. After walking for more than 3 kilometers, I reached the mouth of the valley. Eccentric shapes on the valley's walls began to attract all my attention. But what had made this valley outstanding was something beyond these peculiar shapes. The Chahku Canyon is a type of deep, narrow valley with a stone floor. But what distinguishes this from other valleys, like the Kalajeni in Tabaz and the Kula Khersan in Lorestan, is the existence of these water wells, in addition to geometrical shapes on these walls, like these holes. Some of them are like human or animal heads. This all has distinguished the valley, giving it a very beautiful appearance. It is still full of water. By reserving fresh water, these water wells have been playing a vital role for the villagers of Chaku. The locals dug these wells around 400 years ago so as to have access to fresh groundwater here for their own consumption, as well as the consumption of their livestock. Some believe that the name of this valley derives from the name of the man-dug wells in this valley. Others believe the valley owes its name to the existence of a deep natural well created through erosion inside it. What is very clear in relation to Chaku is that the locals have learned from nature that they can dig water wells here inside the valley to reserve rainwater inside them. In fact, nature in this valley has appeared as a kind of smart teacher for the locals who are always faced with water shortage. These natural and man-made wells have attracted many birds to this place. The beautiful gazelle of Rejm, which needs protection, is seen in the wildlife of the Chaku Valley. In fact, the first well here has not been dug by the hands of men, but by nature. Long before, the locals came here to meet their need for water through these wells. Nature, with its own hands, had carved these holes in here. The depths of these wells, for instance, the depth of the well I am standing by right now is about 7 to 8 meters, I guess. In fact, nature has taught the locals to have access to water through digging wells in the valley because after rain, these holes would be filled with water. Little by little, the locals came to the conclusion that they could easily dig wells in this valley to use both rainwater and groundwater. Nature has made these wells through the process of erosion. The more you explore this valley, the more you want to spend time in it. You cannot imagine how beautiful it is here. You keep coming across new forms and shapes. The holes known as pigeon holes, they are the result of wind and water erosion. After rain, water here would reach a height of 8 to 9 meters. Imagine that amount of water moving through this narrow valley. It would carve these pigeon holes here, making the valley wonderful and unique. When it rains here, the valley acts like a natural gutter. Nature has carved this place in the best possible way. This place becomes very attractive in the rain. Of course, it is not pouring with rain, otherwise it would be very dangerous for tourists who might lose their lives if caught here when floodwaters are sweeping across the valley. And the Chaku Crossroads. I finally reached this point. The general form of the Chaku Canyon is like a crossroads. In fact, this valley has been created by two chasms crisscrossing each other. This point is exactly the Chaku Crossroads. It looks like a plus sign from above. is so narrow that I cannot get through. I have to go on through the upper part. I think that the end of the valley has no way out, just like the other valley I walked in. But this place is so beautiful and the shapes on its walls are so interesting that professional photographers might wish to stay here for weeks to take incredible pictures, on condition that they have enough food and a good place to sleep. And of course, they should not leave garbage here. I have walked through numerous valleys so far, valleys so much deeper and longer than the Chahku Valley. But I dare say that the Chahku Valley is the most beautiful one I have ever walked through so far in terms of form and geology. I'm waiting impatiently for the day when all of us cherish our own rich culture and history and do our best to preserve and enjoy all God has given us. I am really waiting for that day. How narrow this part is. It reminds me of Kula Kherson in Lorestan province. From this point on, it gets very difficult to go through. I mean, it's a mistake to go through the part without technical equipment because the passage is very dangerous with a deep, snaky floor. So, in a way, I have come to the end of this leg of my journey in the Chahku Valley. Walking through the Chahku Valley and admiring its wildlife filled me with good vibes, energy, and peace. But the attraction of the area is not confined to this. Thanks to towering walls, the valley is almost protected from light pollution coming from the city. That means you can have a bright starlit sky in the darkness of Earth. The night sky is one of the most beautiful things you can have in this area. There is yet another attraction on the beaches of Reshm Island. In fact, one of the main attractions in the island, the mangrove or Hara forests of Reshm. The mangrove tree is a shrub or a small tree that grows in coastal saline or brackish water, representing an important ecological resource. The mangrove forests of Reshm covers an area of approximately 9,000 hectares. They are regarded as the largest sea forests in the whole Persian Gulf. Mangroves are salt-tolerant trees and are adapted to life in harsh coastal conditions. They contain a complex salt filtration system and complex root system to cope with saltwater immersion and wave action. They're also adapted to the low oxygen conditions of waterlogged mud. It was very interesting for me to sail through different parts of these forests because in addition to their own beauty, they were home to diverse species of birds, amphibians, and fish. It was time to leave the Chaku area and head for another geosite in Reshma Island called the Valley of Stars. The Valley of Stars is located 5 kilometers from the southern beaches of Reshma Island. The soil of the valley is so light that a long, heavy rain can change easily the appearance of the valley itself. This process has been continuing for more than 2 million years. The end of the valley. Inside the Valley of Stars is marked with numerous furrows and passages with no ways out. Each crack I have walked through here has been a dead end. I have to find a passage with a way out. When the wind blows through the valley, it makes eccentric noises. That is mainly due to the valley's special inner structure. In the past, the locals believed that those noises belonged to jinns, but the fact is something else. The fact is that when the wind blows through this valley, it makes different noises as it hits these different shapes and landforms. But what you should be afraid of are human beings rather than jinns. Over the past few days, I've had this amount of garbage, and I have it all in a plastic bag. I think it is a good idea to throw it away right here. But, what do you think? Why should I carry it with me all along? If I throw garbage here, when other tourists, who also like to enjoy this pristine place, come here, they will be faced with this ugly scene instead. I'm just one person, and in just a few days, I have had this amount of garbage, and if I leave it here in nature, it'll be like this. And I firmly believe that the nature represents God's own beauty. How could I dare throw this amount of garbage here in nature and deface it? Unfortunately, some tourists leave garbage in nature, which is, in fact, the manifestation of God's beauty and glory. And when a tourist like I, who loves exploring and taking pictures in nature or simply walking in clean, pristine landscapes, comes here, they might face this ugly, disgusting scene instead. I personally cannot even imagine throwing even a small amount of garbage in nature. Do not worry. I just threw the garbage here to show you how we can make nature unattractive with throwing garbage recklessly. But if I collect garbage and clean this place up, other tourists who come here would also enjoy wandering around. I have personally never left garbage in nature. I think the best thing for us to do is to leave no traces in nature and pass nature as pristine as possible to future generations, as our ancestors who were nature-loving people passed it on to us as pristine as possible. If we do not plant trees in nature, the least thing we can do is to avoid throwing away garbage in it. It is the least thing we can do for nature and for our dear country. The floor of the Valley of Stars is covered with fossils and mussel and snail shells. It shows that the whole area and, of course, Reshma Island as a whole was underwater millions of years ago. When it rains heavily, the thin powder-like layer of the ground is washed away and all these shells come to the surface, creating an amazing scene here in the valley. By the way, when I come to this area, I try not to take away these shells because they are beautiful if they remain here. Just imagine if tourists who come here take away some of these shells. Nothing will be left after a while. I've come across many fossils in rock here. Everywhere is full of these mussel and snail shells. Beautiful shapes and natural statue-like formations in the Valley of Stars is very attractive to tourists. But the night sky of this amazing valley can attract many photographers and stargazers, especially at moonlit nights when light, shadow, and eccentric shapes create a wonderful ambience inside the Valley of Stars. I was coming to the end of my trip. I went to the amazing island of Resp to watch its nature, wildlife, geosites, and pristine beaches, as well as its local architecture and culture. The island is unique in terms of its diverse tourist attractions and its high potential for ecotourism. I left this beautiful island in the Persian Gulf, leaving the least possible traces of myself behind.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Ilm-e fiqh az ulum-e sharifiye islami.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant practice.
Imamat yek asl zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. Please stay tuned.
فاسد کردن حرص تو قرآن اومده و این کار طاغوتی ها هست.
In the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Baqarah, Ayah 205, we read, If he were to wield authority, he would try to cause corruption in the land and to ruin the crop and the stock. And Allah does not like corruption. Islam bans the people from spitting on a fruit tree, urinating on a tree, and to put the garbage in the rivers. It is very much good for a Muslim to rethink about his behaviors during the springtime when the nature becomes new again. We must take a deep look to our past to see whether we solve the problems of people or not.
دیدن خودمونم بریم ببینیم احوالمون چطوره.
In better words, springtime is a good chance to visit ourselves again. Besides visiting the relatives and friends in the new year, we must reflect upon our own actions too. There must be always this question in our minds that, how could I be a better Muslim in such and such behavior? New Year for a Muslim must be full of reflection upon past and self-correction. We must learn many lessons from springtime and nature as a Muslim. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. To find out more about this program, please log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week we evaluate a trending news story and we break it down from an Islamic perspective. With Muslims observing the holy month of Ramadan, many will be engaging in social activities with their brothers and sisters, including iftars, communal prayers, and events aimed at propagating Islam to non-Muslims. But in recent years, we've seen the Zionist lobby and its collaborators in the Muslim community propagating efforts that on the surface appear to be harmless interfaith events, but are actually attempts to normalize the Zionist regime to Muslims around the world. In this week's episode, we'll look at how these attempts are made, and we'll explore what Muslims must do to remain alert to them. First, we take a look at some specific examples of the kind of individuals and organizations that are engaging in such normalization actions.
Interfaith denotes a harmony for all and elevates the idea of coexistence. However, in recent years, they have become vehicles for normalizing Zionism in the Muslim community. The peaceful, multi-faith community-building exercise has been hijacked by some in the hopes of weaponizing the goodwill between believers in the Abrahamic faiths. One such group is called Nisat Nashim, a Muslim and Jewish female-only network that engages in superficial-level discussions on religious matters in the hopes of utilizing the friendships formed under the banner of interfaith harmony and worship to silence criticism on Israel. In an event they held over preparations for the holy month of Ramadan and the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur, they repeated that we must celebrate what our similarities are and respect our differences. They later clarified that this statement was not regarding theological differences, but specifically in relation to the settler colonial Israel. However, this is not surprising, as the pro-Israel Board of Deputies of British Jews admits that it incubated Nisat Nashim for this purpose. Not only is this group funded by the Board of Deputies, but also by David Dangor, whose family also funds the Islamophobic Henry Jackson Society. Such infiltration requires Muslim accomplices. The co-founder of Nisat Nashim, Julie Siddiqui, is also the co-founder of the Big Iftar and works as a Muslim interfaith consultant for the Kosher Iftar, established at a pro-Israel synagogue. She has a long history of working with the British Armed Forces, which she has openly stated is something we should be proud of. Critics say that personalities like Siddiqui are the Muslim face of Zionism and hugely damage the value of interfaith work in multi-faith, multicultural societies like the UK.
Now, joining us on the show this week to discuss this extremely important topic are two very special guests. We are honoured to be joined by Reverend Dr. Stephen Sizer, the founder and director of Peacemaker Trust, a UK charity dedicated to peacemaking, especially where minorities are persecuted, where justice is denied and human rights are suppressed. Stephen is also chair of the Covivencia Alliance and the director of the Institute for the Study of Christian Zionism, as well as being a member of the executive of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. He's a retired Anglican priest, but continues to serve as chaplain to the former Bishop of Jerusalem, Bishop Riyah Abul Essel. We are also pleased to welcome a favourite of the show back, Sayyid Ammar Kazmi, who helps run the Left Legal Fighting Fund, a legal defence fund which focuses on assisting anti-racist, anti-fascist and anti-Zionist individuals and groups who need legal support. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to you both. Reverend Sizer, if I could start here with yourself, how would you define interfaith and what are the benefits of such dialogue and events?
Interfaith is about people of different faiths coming together to understand one another's background. It's not about proselytism. It's about complementing, collaborating on issues of common concern, whether it's poverty or racism, extremism, or in a case at the moment, Gaza. It's about listening rather than speaking. It's about empathizing, putting ourselves in the shoes of the other and finding what we have in common common cause and then working together to ameliorate, whether it's natural disasters, human suffering or extremism.
So then what would you say the Zionist movement seeks to achieve by engaging in interfaith, in what some have described as soft war strategy? Why are they spending time, effort and money perhaps speaking to people who may oppose their ideology?
Well, we've just been describing what I would call authentic interfaith dialogue, where we treat one another as equals, respectful and seeking to understand one another. The kind of interfaith dialogue that the Zionist movement engages in is very different. It's along the lines of we set the agenda and therefore you cannot criticize Israel. So it becomes a tool to suppress human rights, suppress challenging Israel's actions. So, for example, in the UK, we have the Council of Christians and Jews, CCJ,